Welcome to the Ecclesia Hollywood Podcast. Make sure to visit us online at churchinhollywood.com.
If you could please welcome up Dr. Doug Guyvett to the stage. You can work all of this out while brag about you for just a second. He's going to work out the slides so that they are copacetic with our system here. And while he does that, I'm going to give you reason to pay attention to him. Dr. Doug Guyvett is a local, but he is someone who has spoken and authored several different works that address a lot of the big questions we've got in this series. He, let me just list off the credentials here. I've got this scripted because there are so many. Doug Guyvett is the professor of philosophy of religion and ethics at Talbot School of Theology and Biola University. Go Eagles. Okay. He holds a bachelor's of science in religious education from Multnomah. Really? Okay. Master's in biblical studies from Dallas Theological Seminary. Okay. Master's in philosophy from Gonzaga. Wow. Okay. And a PhD in philosophy from USC. There you go. There it was. He's the author, like I said before, of several books. I'll list a couple here. Evil and the Evidence for God. He's contributed to other books like God Under Fire, The Rationality of Theism, and Does God Exist? The Craig Flew Debate. He's also co-editor of In Defense of Miracles, A Comprehensive Case for God's Action in History, and one of my favorites, Contemporary Perspectives on Religious Epistemology. I'm serious. It's very, very good. Three times as exciting as it sounds. Dr. Guyvett is also the former president of the Evangelical Philosophical Society. He is the husband of one woman, Diane. He's got two grown daughters. Don't let the tie fool you. He loves kayaking and motorcycle riding, and you're going to hear more of his personality in just a second. But once again, with all of your grace and your attention spans, could you please welcome our guest, Dr. Doug Guyvett.
It's great to be here with you this morning. I said that because that's what you're supposed to say. I want to thank the Warner Brothers for this wonderful facility. When Joseph invited me to speak, he didn't tell me that I would be receiving an Oscar for my work in philosophy. That'll be the day. My field is philosophy, and in philosophy there are specializations. And one of those is called epistemology. Sounds very impressive. Maybe not, but it concerns an area of study, philosophical study, about knowledge. Is there such a thing as knowledge? If so, how do you acquire knowledge? In what areas can we have knowledge? Epistemology is concerned with those things. Now, occasionally, when I'm introduced to somebody, because of my background, I am introduced as Dr. Guyvett. And this can be awkward at times. Usually when this happens, I am asked, what kind of doctor are you? And I used to tell them the truth. I used to tell them, well, I have a PhD in philosophy, and I teach at a university. We're out of here. And that's not the kind of response you want to get when they're the ones who ask the question. And since this was happening so frequently, I decided I needed to figure out why it was happening. This is something I would lie awake at night pondering. This is what we do in philosophy. And it struck me finally one night, like a bolt, that they wanted to know my medical specialization, right? Finally occurred to me. And so I thought, well, I can give them an alternative. And now when somebody asks me, what kind of doctor are you? I just tell them I'm an epistemologist. It's true. It's not a medical specialization, but it's true. But they think it is. And they don't know how to respond. You know, they don't walk away. They're just kind of frozen on the spot. You know, what do I say? What do I do? And they're quiet. And you can see the wheels turning. They don't want to ask you, what's an epistemologist? Maybe because they feel like they're supposed to know. But maybe it's because I don't know if what part of the body we're talking about here. Do I really want to know? Epistemology. I've actually done this. And then I have to go home and ask for forgiveness, you know. Growing up, I actually liked school. And I loved books, words also. Everybody knew it was a bad sign when I asked for a thesaurus for my 10th birthday. Yeah. Or you could say it was a bad omen, a bad indicator, a bad portent, a bad augury, a bad harbinger, or a bad betoken. When you're in grade school, they say you're precocious. Never mind that you're the only one in the room who knows what that means. But when you move on to junior high, it's different. That's when you graduate to nerd status. Yeah, amen. I'm in company with friends. Eventually, you get used to it. You resign yourself to the fact that you are an egghead. And so you graduate from high school when you're 12 years old, and you go on for another 20 years of education. But the day comes when you've got all those degrees, the diplomas, right, the fancy letters after your name, which mean nothing. When they invite you to speak in chapel, at commencement, at some conference, or at church. And this is when you get your revenge. You're up here, they're down there. They've come to listen to you. Now you know why public speakers, and especially university professors, always exceed the allotted time. It's not an accident. It's not coincidental. It's not a fluke. It's not inadvertent. It's not uncalculated or unintentional. Thank you, Roger. It is revenge. The truth is, I love having the opportunity to share my research, to equip other people, and to stimulate conversation. Everybody in this room has opportunities for cultural engagement that I will never have. I have students who aspire to have more education. And the fact is, the more education you have, the more difficulty you have engaging dimensions of society. It pulls you out of ordinary life sometimes and puts you places where you need to be. That's true. And so a lot of my life is lived in the university, nationally, internationally, talking about the ideas, some of the things that we'll be talking about today. But that's my world. That's not your world for most of you. There may be some people that do this too. But you're in a world where you have a unique contribution to make. I think everybody here is probably in a position to utilize the material that will be presented, not only today, but in the series of 7 presentations. Reasons why people have trouble believing Christianity. Our topic today is science and Christian belief. Can you see that okay up there? And the question we have is this: are they compatible? A lot of people think they're not. You can't mix the two. You got to go with science or you can go with Christian belief. You can be intelligent or you can be irrational. You can get it right, or you can be superstitious. Now, it's okay to be superstitious as long as you don't hurt anybody. want to put what we're going to talk about into a context that comes from the Bible. I think it'll be interesting for you to see how contemporary the author is in writing something that he put on the page 2,000 years ago. The passage is 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verses 18 through 21. Now, you may not be that familiar with the New Testament. The Bible has two testaments, Old and New. And the book of 1 Corinthians is a letter that the Apostle Paul wrote to a church in Corinth. That's why it's called Corinthians. It's called 1 Corinthians because it's the first of several letters that he wrote, at least two of which are in our Bible. And so you can find this in the table of contents of your Bible in the New Testament section and turn to that passage. But I'm going to place it on the screen and read it to you. The chapter is divided, the book is divided into several chapters, and each chapter, to make it easy for reference, is divided into verses. And I'm going to be reading verses 18 through 21. The author says, "Let no one deceive you or deceive himself. If anyone among you thinks that he is wise in this age, let him become a fool that he may become wise. For the wisdom of this world is folly with God. For it is written, he catches the wise in their craftiness. And again, the Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. So let no one boast in men." We need to come back to this passage at the end of the presentation, because then I think you'll see the connection even better. But let me put it this way. Today, the wisdom of the world can be captured in one word. What is that word? Science. Today, people believe in science. They don't just believe what scientists tell us. They believe in science. They count on science. They organize their lives around scientific discoveries and technologies. Science is the be-all and the end-all for knowledge. That's how it is for most people. This is the wisdom of this age. Now, that's just how it is. You may not like what the apostle wrote in the rest of the verse, but you've got to agree that really is the wisdom of this age. That's where things stand. Now, here's what he says. If anyone thinks that he is wise in this age, let him become a fool in order to become wise. Now, I think what's going on here is he's saying it's fine to absorb the values of science and to learn from it and to apply what you know and to appreciate it. But if that's all you think is really worth thinking about, if that's the only way to know anything according to you, if that's the wisdom that you rely on for everything, then you need to take a broader perspective and step back and realize how foolish and futile that really is. And you need to unite it with the wisdom of God. You don't have to abandon science, but you need to bring the two together. The Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. So let no one boast in men. There's a lot of boasting in the field of science. We have prizes that we give out, and people who want those prizes, and they compete with each other for those prizes. And then we have universities, and it's more prestigious to go to teach at one university than another. It's more prestigious to be a research scientist than it is to be teaching in the classroom all the time. It's more significant when you're celebrated for all the books that you write and you get on television. Now, you don't hear a lot of boasting out loud, but there is a lot of it in the heart. I know the temptations of this myself. Now, there are some who do, it seems, reveal the pride of their lives in their grip on the wisdom of this age. They are in the grip of that ideology. And so I think this verse is incredibly, incredibly contemporary. Now, we have to acknowledge the progress and the value of science. Sure, we've learned a lot. Thank you. I must be clearing my throat. Scientists have figured out how to purify water and bottle it in plastic containers and medicate you if you get sick drinking the water. They know how to do these things. This is the progress of science. There have been major strides in science. Here we have a picture of a very crude instrument that really represented a major advance in science. But now we have the Hubble telescope out there exploring the vast regions of the universe and sending the information back to us. That's what we can do now. That's the Hubble telescope. But we also have the Human Genome Project, the mapping of the microscopic, of the self, the individual, your body and mine, figuring out the unique signature of your DNA code. We're working on that now. Francis Collins is the national head of the Human Genome Project. He has now been called upon by President Obama to explore some new directions in this regard. By the way, this man is a Christian. Just thought you'd like to know. But he converted to Christianity relatively recently. And I'll tell you the book he read that helped him. So that if you need help in this area, just to think through some of the issues, you might find this book. It's called Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. Many intellectuals have come to faith through reading this book. In fact, C.S. Lewis was a man in the academy in Oxford who himself came to faith late in life. There have been major strides in science. We see this at the macroscopic level. I thought I'd show you a couple pictures of how this is seen at the microscopic level, just to kind of appreciate deeper the world we live in. Did you ever want to see a housefly this close up? I don't. I'm satisfied with a picture. But this is incredible detail. You can now take pictures with the kinds of lenses we have of flies that reveal this degree of precision. Now, there's a prettier picture I can show you. This one is a picture of cells taken from a mouse. Probably another creature you don't really like seeing around your house. But there's a kind of beauty there, isn't there? And structure and order. And science has revealed this and make it possible for us to see into that world. It's magnificent. Science wields a significant social power and influence in our lives, in the culture, and rightly so. But what about the relationship between science and religion? Does this mean that we have to exclude religion because there's so much value in science? And I think the answer should be no. There are four views, basic views, about how you relate science and religion. Here they are. One is called the conflict view. It sort of speaks for itself. The second is the independence view. The third is called the dialogue view, and then the integration view is the fourth. I want to go through these with you. And as I do, I want to make comments about lessons we can learn about the proper relationship between science and faith. Let's come first of all to this picture that it really reflects the conflict view. This is a picture, a painting of Galileo standing before a priest who represents the authority of the Roman Catholic Church. And he is really on trial here for his claims that seem to be incompatible with what the Bible teaches. And because a certain view of the solar system had been assumed on the basis of a particular interpretation of a passage in the Bible, it became doctrinal and doctrinaire within the church. So that if a scientist like Galileo came along and said, I don't think that's quite right, here's the right view, that was an embarrassment to the church, they took offense, and rather than adjust their view by going back and seeing whether or not they actually interpreted the scriptures correctly, they tried to get him to renounce his view. This is the conflict view. Not a lot of dialogue here. Not a lot of opportunity for the scientist to engage. This was a time when the church held greater authority than science did. Here's a cartoon. I don't think you're going to be able to read this. I can barely read it myself. But there are these two student-looking characters. And the guy says to the girl, "I refuse to let the Bible tell me what to do and how to think. I use my own mind to decide for myself what I should do with my life." So she asks the question. "That's interesting. How did you decide to think that way?" And here's what he says. "My college professor told me that's what I should do." This is actually not far from the truth. And that's part of the humor in it. It's also part of the tragedy. I went to college, and I took a course in astronomy, the physics of the universe. It's not astrology. Astronomy. Physics course. My teacher developed a whole course around the subject of the Big Bang and the evolution of the stars and the emergence of the solar system and the Earth. And her name was Professor Starr. So she knew her calling very early in life. And one day she was lecturing on the Big Bang and the energy that went into the explosion that brought forth this universe. It was very impressive to hear the evidence. This theory is still the prominent theory among scientists today. Well, there was a student in the class, young woman, who raised her hand. She looked a little timid, but you could tell she felt like this was a chance I need to take. And so she raised her hand, and the prof called on her. But she said this, "I'll bet I know what you want to ask." I'd never heard that one before. You know, an astronomer who can actually read minds. So she said, "You want to know where the energy came from, don't you?" We're all nodding, we're all saying yes to that question. And I couldn't wait to hear the answer. Here's the answer. This is all she said. "Well, some people believe that the energy came from God. But that's not very scientific, is it?" And then she went back to her lecture. Well, what is the scientific answer? And why didn't she give it to you? Was it just like an oversight? "Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot. That wasn't in my lecture notes." Now, if she knew that was the question, it should have been in her lecture notes. Don't you think? That means she thought about it herself? We had a lot of conversations, this teacher and I. And I wish I could tell you. Do we have university students in the audience? I wish I could take time this morning to give you some encouraging words about how to relate to challenges to your faith, if you're a believer, in the classroom. Maybe afterwards, if you want to talk about that, we can. But one of the primary principles you have to act on is respect for your prof. And with the greatest respect, I used to discuss issues with my prof after class. And one day she said, you're a religious person, aren't you?" And I kind of liked it that she hadn't figured it out for a while. That showed that I wasn't just sort of jumping into that. And she said, "You're kind of a religious person, aren't you?" And I said, "Well, I'm a Christian." She said, "Well, that counts." Okay. She said, "Now that's okay." And of course, I was relieved. And she said, "But you really should not be out there," and she's kind of thinking of the university context, "as a missionary with your views trying to convince other people." Now, I had to restrain myself from saying the following. "So it's okay for you as a missionary of science to try to persuade me of your position, but it's not okay for me to do that." See, there's something wrong with this picture. And it comes from this attitude called scientism. Not science, scientism. Now, there's a connection, for sure. But isms are points of view. They are ideologies. And this is an ideology that's committed to a certain view of science. And it is in great tension with theism. Theism is the view that God exists. And that God has certain properties. And God is interested in the human condition, the universe. Here's an argument for scientism. Scientism holds that whatever can be known must be known through the sciences. Now, there may be things that you can't know any other way. There may be things you can't know by the sciences, but that just means those are things you can't know at all. So, whatever can be known must be known through the sciences. Here's the argument. If science is our only source of knowledge, then the only things we can know are physical objects. Science is our only source of knowledge, therefore, the only things we can know are physical objects. Now, that is the scientism point of view. And it is in diametric opposition to theism. Now, here's where you spin the argument the other direction. If science is our only source of knowledge, then the only things we can know are physical objects. Yeah, that premise is true. But now, look at premise two. It is not the case that physical objects are the only things that we can know. Therefore, science is not our only source of knowledge. Now, what are some things we can know beyond science? Well, notice, if the scientist claims to know that science is the only way we can know things, that had better be something we know using the sciences. But it isn't. That's a philosophical thesis that is not empirically verifiable. No observation, no experiment is going to support that claim. And it's got to be false because of that. Now, it's not like there are no true philosophical claims. There are. But this can't be one of them, because that would be a denial of itself. The only way you can know anything is through science? Well, tell me how you do that with that principle. Can't be done. So it hoists itself on its own petard. I don't really know what that means, but I've heard it. I've heard it in situations like this. Who talks that way? Professors. I don't want comments from the audience. There are other things we can know. Lots of other things we can know. You know that certain actions are morally wrong. They're not just repugnant, they are wrong. You think they're repugnant, you respond that way because you know that they're wrong. The rape of a woman in a dark alley, that's wrong. To torture a baby on the end of a bayonet just for pleasure, which is done, is wrong. Does anybody here disagree with that? That is factually true. That's wrong. Now give me the science that shows that that's true. There is no scientific argument for that. You cannot demonstrate that empirically. There must be some other way. We know that to be true. There are other things that we can know. But if these are things we can know apart from science, that opens up the possibility of knowing other things as well. Scientism is in trouble. It is an ideology at odds with responsible scientific practice. You don't have to embrace scientism to be a good scientist. In fact, to the degree that you do embrace scientism, you are an irresponsible scientist. Now, we've been talking about different models, different ways of relating science and religion. That's the conflict model. Now we come to the independence model. You just kind of go your separate ways. Now we're hearing from this person down in the corner, very quietly observing, you know, trying to be inconspicuous. And she's kind of under her breath, she says, you know, you could go your separate ways. This is called aesthetic interpretation. Just telling you my understanding of the painting. But here's what going the different directions looks like. One says science, the other one says religion. They got their nose in the books, they're not talking to each other, they got their backs turned. They're on their own individual path, they're in different lanes. That's the independence model. You can see the effect of the independence model. You're really not sure what the relation is when they're independent. You know this guy. He's been forced by his teacher, maybe it's his Sunday school teacher, to write out this sentence. Science and Christianity do not conflict. Science and Christianity do not conflict. And if you repeat that enough, maybe you'll believe it. But that's not the idea here. The idea isn't just to get yourself to believe it and to sort of split them off from each other. One of the great problems with scientism and the failure to find a better way to relate the two, science and faith, comes in the area of other values that we have. We value human life, we value relationship, we value certain kinds of emotional experiences and objectives. Here's an illustration. A lot of movies today reflect a concern about the end of human history, don't they? They're called apocalyptic or dysteleological. Look, professors aren't the only ones who use fancy. Look, that's Hollywood doing that. Apocalyptic films. Everything's going to grow dark. There's going to be the destruction of the world. You might have one person left. What a joy he has, right? But he's going to figure out how to fix it. Why are there so many films about this today? Didn't used to be that way. You know, films reflect culture. Films reflect culture and they also shape culture. I teach a course on faith, film, and philosophy. And this is one of the things we talk about. Film reflects culture. You see, the reason why people will watch a movie is because it can resonate with their soul, their spirit. That means that the film is reflecting something about themselves. A sense of the malaise of the human condition. How bad things are. How worse they may get. We're not on the right course. Yes, there are days when we can go out for an ice cream sundae. But those days are numbered. That's the feeling. The film reflects this. But also, oftentimes, our films are edgy and they try to pull us in a new direction. And they try to shape culture. You know about that, too. Here's a film called Oblivion, starring Tom Cruise. Earth is a memory. What? Earth is a memory. Whose memory? How can you have a memory with nobody to remember anything? Anyway, Earth is a memory worth fighting for. So not only do you need somebody to have the memory, now you need somebody to fight for it. And that's who he is. Right? Tom Cruise does that sort of thing. I mean, he's that good. Right? This is Mission Impossible. Okay, now, I want to ask this question. Earth is a memory worth fighting for? Why? Why? It's valuable. We think it's worthwhile. Why? Worth refers to value. Now, science will tell us the likelihood that the solar system will burn up, that the Earth will become uninhabitable. It can make predictions about that, and it does. It probably won't happen in your lifetime, so you don't have to worry about that, or your children's or your grandchildren. And after that, it's kind of like, well, who are those people? Right? I've traced my genealogy back to the 16th century. Okay. But why do we care? We do. We don't want it to all sort of end. We don't want oblivion. All right? We value. Now, science will tell us that oblivion is in our future, but it can't tell us what to do about it in the meantime. It might be able to say, well, for the time being, we should stop using styrofoam and a few things like that. You know, be careful with the fuels you burn, and maybe we'll slow down global warming. Look, people, global warming is the least of our worries. This universe really is headed for oblivion. The energy of the universe will eventually be used up, and everything will become static. It will be quiescent. All the noise that you hear, it's gone. But we value. See, it's not enough to know that it's going to happen. It's just, we don't want it to happen. Even if we know it will, we don't want it to. And that's what drives us to try to stop it. And what do we use? Science. Science doesn't explain the value we place on it, but it gives us a way to act on our values. You see? Now, what about love? Now, what does the really hard-boiled scientist say about this? Well, dear, my synapses are firing, and I feel, well, I don't feel anything, to be honest with you, but my body is doing something, and it's happening in relationship to your body. You got any synapses firing in my direction? Now, don't you think that's just going a little too far with your science? Well, it is, but not so if that's all there is to reality. Because you're just describing what we think of as emotions in purely physical terms. And maybe there are things you can't do anything about. Because it's all determined anyway. Now, that's not the way we like to think about love, is it? Is it? No. I'll answer that for you. So another view is dialogue. If independence isn't such a good way to go, maybe we can talk to each other. And so Galileo, the scientist, oddly enough, is the first one to say, let's talk. And strangely enough, agreed. Now, I don't have a lot to say about dialogue because it seems to me that dialogue by itself doesn't accomplish much. It's not clear that it's that different than independence. Because you can just go separate ways doing your research, but then, you know, sit down and have coffee, as long as you don't talk about your research. Or you can go in a stronger direction that's called integration. This is the fourth view. Now, we've had three of the four with something to say. But there's this one chap off to the side, sort of being left out. He doesn't say anything, but this is what he's thinking. They seem to be working on the same toward the same ends. They have the same goals. Maybe they should integrate. Again, my artistic interpretation. Well, what is integration? Is this integration? You cannot put integration on a bumper, right? It has to be a real working together towards a legitimate end. Right? You don't do it by saying, oh, well, you know, Christians, you know, we like to fish. And but we also have our own science fiction. So you have Christian science fiction. You can have Christian everything. But you have to go to a Christian bookstore to find it, right? That's not integration. This is a picture of integration. People from different disciplines. This is a painting by Raphael. It's a fresco in the Vatican, if I'm not mistaken. And they are representative of different intellectual traditions and disciplines, and they are in dialogue with each other. There's a certain amount of independence going on as they work in their own research area, and then they come together. That's what we should be doing. Now, it's true that science does give us knowledge, and it does warrant a re-evaluation of theistic claims to whatever degree. So if science can really push God out of the picture, then we have to accept that. It hasn't happened. There have been a lot of changes in science. There are many fundamental principles thought to be fundamental about science that are no longer accepted. And we can make a list. Science is always undergoing change, revision. Thomas Kuhn called these paradigm changes, revolutions. But Christianity has survived not only 2,000 centuries of various kinds of opposition, but it survived scientism. Nevertheless, if there are things that science can do that theism cannot do in explaining the world, then we need to pay attention. Now, scientists will often say, well, then that means you're in trouble because science can explain everything. Well, it can eventually. Not today, maybe, but look at its track record. It will eventually explain everything. And we won't need God where we think we need God. Well, where you think we need God. So we don't need a God of the gaps. It's called the God of the gaps. Because wherever we find a gap in our understanding about what goes on in the physical universe, we just plug God in there and that fills the gap. We say, miracle, and then we move on. And things go a while, and then, oops, there's a gap, miracle. You know, and scientists think that's a little bit ad hoc. Now, I do know what that means. Let me see if I can say what it means, right? Ad hoc means you're just doing that to defend your own position. You don't have a good independent reason for doing it. All right? So, what do we say to that? We say, fine, when science can bridge those gaps, welcome to it. However, there are some gaps for science. Let's go back to the origin of the universe, shall we? Let's not, the scientists might say. Or scientists might say, okay, fine, but that's as far back as we can go. Well, yeah, it's the beginning. But how did it begin? Where did it come from? In my doctoral program, I had a very sophisticated university professor developing a whole course on the theory of causation, in which he said one day, apparently the universe just popped into existence. You have to go to university to find these things out. Write that one down. That might be on the test. Now, explain that. How do things pop? There's always a set of antecedent conditions. Things don't just pop by themselves. There has to be something popping. Right? You go get the popcorn. It's not popped, but there is something there that gets popped. Okay. So how does something pop into existence out of nothing? Well, there is no answer to that. You know what they call that? A brute fact. That's a fancy word, phrase, for we have no idea. And we're not ever going to figure it out either. We're just comfortable with that. Well, why are you comfortable with that? Well, because science can't answer that. That's why. Well, is it possible that science can't answer some other questions, like where did life come from? What about the origin of human consciousness, which is not reducible to the activity of the brain? I won't go into the details for that. That'd be for another time. So science may warrant reevaluation of theism, but this does not entail that theism must be cast aside, nor does it entail that science has nothing to do, nothing to learn from theism. In fact, science owes its fruitfulness to theism. Science was birthed in the context of the Christian intellectual tradition. The first scientists, real scientists, were Christians. They were theists. And the reason why that happened is not coincidental. The reason why it happened is because they believed in an intelligent being who created the universe and made it intelligible by giving it order and regularity so that you could count on things from one day to the next. And he created intelligent critters like ourselves who can actually make sense of things by learning the laws of nature. And so we have the birth of science. It's not a coincidence. And then science develops. Also, science owes its fruitfulness to theism because theism can provide us with questions for science. What if Jesus really did rise from the dead? Well, that can't be because resurrections don't happen. Why not? Science. Well, okay, but what if it happened? What if we have really good historical evidence that it did happen? What are you going to do? I don't know. Brute fact? I don't know. Maybe some alien? I don't. What? No, they have to really insist that the historical evidence just isn't good enough. So no matter how good it is, it's not good enough because that's not possible. Why? Because they know that if they agree to that, there will be no scientific solution. That would be a huge gap for science. There's a philosopher named Colin McGinn, a naturalist, who has argued in a book on consciousness that we really have no idea how to explain it. And he calls his view Mysterianism. Enough said. Science provides greater support for theism than for materialistic naturalism. Okay? There are scientific arguments for God's existence, origin of the universe, cosmic design, and so on. In review, there are four chief views on the relationship between science and religion: the conflict view, the independence view, the dialogue view, and the integration view. Here are some lessons we've learned. One, science wields significant social power. True. Science may warrant reevaluation of theism. Okay. Number three, this does not entail that theism must be cast aside. Agreed. Number four, scientism is an ideology at odds with responsible scientific practice. Do science, but not as an ideology. Number five, science owes its fruitfulness to theism. And finally, number six, science provides greater support for theism than for materialistic naturalism. The question today is, what is your worldview? If you're a naturalist, you deny the existence of God. And then there are lots of things you have to say about how things are in the world and with respect to human beings because you're a naturalist. You're forced to say those things. And I think you have to deny that we have freedom of self-determination. I think you have to deny that we're morally responsible. I think you have to deny that we have souls and consciousness. I think you have to deny that there's a non-scientific way to know morals and hence nothing to be known. Those are things I think you're compelled to deny if you're a naturalist. What is your worldview? Is that where you're at today? Now, if you're a theist, this whole world of intuitive explanation is now available to you. There can be morals because there's a moral lawgiver. Consciousness comes from a conscious mind that created us that way, and so on. What is your worldview? That question is very, I'm not asking you that intellectually. It's not like a lecture room I'm asking that question because there's a decision to be made. What is your next move? What will you believe? Now, this picture is what some with scientism think is representative of the religious person. Really? Maybe we need to have a dialogue. Maybe we both need to get our heads out of the sand and talk, integrate. We can embrace science. Now, it really comes down to a question of what you worship. To what or to whom do you owe your primary allegiance? Remember, I said the wisdom of this world is science, apart from God. A greater wisdom is science wedded to the wisdom of God. But you see, if you are a naturalist, that's all you've got. You don't have anything more transcendent than that. Everything in your life is ordered around, in effect, the order or will of science. But if God exists, then God is worthy of worship, and there's a way for it to happen. This is a picture of that. But I think this is a really apt picture of the kind of worship paid to science by human beings who are no longer deeply human. A different picture of what is worshiped. What is your worldview? Now, the Christian worldview says not only that God exists, but says something about the cross and its relationship to reality. We come then to a few other verses in conclusion. 1 Corinthians 2, same author, Paul, same book, says, "For who has understood the mind of the Lord so that as to instruct him?" The hubris of human beings to say, "We get it. We can do it. We can figure it all out by ourselves. We don't need God. In fact, God probably doesn't even exist. If God does, that is hubris to the nth degree, isn't it? I heard someone say, when a naturalist or an atheist has a teenager, he now knows it's like for his own creation to deny his existence. Are we teenagers? Let no one deceive himself. If anyone among you thinks he's wise in this age, let him become a fool that he may become wise. You see, if you really want wisdom, there is a pathway. It starts with humility, but ends with God's perspective. The Lord knows the thoughts of the wise, that they are futile. He means earthly wise. In James chapter 3, the question comes, who is wise, understanding among you? Do not boast and be false to the truth. It's interesting that boasting and being false to the truth can often go together. Sometimes, because you're uncomfortable with the truth, you start to boast. You suppress the truth. You use your PhD and your research and your intelligence to repress and suppress the truth. This is not the wisdom that comes from down from above, but is earthly, unspiritual, demonic. Demonic because there are principalities and powers at work in the world influencing what goes on in God's cosmos. For where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there will be disorder and every vile practice, and we're seeing the decay of society as a result of the movement from theism towards the ideology of scientism, the abandonment of that kind of value. But the wisdom from above is, James says this, open to reason. Open to reason. And so my challenge to you is, do not, this is from Romans 12, do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewal of your mind, that by testing you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. I've gone over my time. Not my prerogative, but what I believe to be my prerogative. So in conclusion, let me repeat the primary thesis of the presentation. Christianity and modern science are compatible. In other words, they are congruent, consonant, congenial, harmonious, in sync with each other, and on the same wavelength. And for those of you who prefer Spanish, they are simpatico. Is this the end, or is it the beginning? It could be the beginning for a number of you. But I want to thank you for your attention. May God bless you.